Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by mischievous Max Montana.
How are you guys doing? All right.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rice and Beans and Power Cleans. It's a lifestyle, and thanks to our YouTube fan, Leroy Rodriguez, for that lifestyle brand. Today we're going to be asking, or rather answering, your questions that you submitted to us via Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, you know, all the places where those kind of things happen. So let's just get right into it. First up, our friend Neville Chu, DPT, asks on Instagram, can weightlifters use RPE-based training the same way powerlifters do?
So not... I would say not entirely, because you can't really do, you know, RPE is going to be more a gauge of fatigue or difficulty that doesn't necessarily exist in weightlifting. The heavier the weight gets, it's not like you're gonna build a snatch, or you could snatch, let's say, 95% of your best very easily and not be able to do any more than that. Where, you know, in powerlifting, you might squat, you know, something that's an 8 RPE, and it's pretty, you're pretty close to what you're going to get, you know, in terms of your best single. So I would say you're not going to have some kind of situation where, oh, I snatched, you know, this weight that's really heavy, but it felt super light and I could do it a bunch of times. Therefore, it's this level of difficulty, because, you know, technical aspects, skill, speed, all those things play into it.
Yeah, I think from a couple standpoints, one, you know, the way that, let's say an 8 RPE would mean that the lifter should be able to do 2 more reps with it. And the likelihood that, you know, something, a weight above 90% in the snatch or the clean and jerk, that they're going to be able to do 3 reps with, you know, everything would be a nine point.
Yeah. Yeah.
5, 10 for weightlifting, because there's just not the capacity for reps the same way that there could be in powerlifting, really, because speed qualities decline, faster.
Right. There's also, I think there's so many other factors there, like the psychological aspect of it, where you can have lifters that are psychologically incapable of executing the lift because it's scary or whatever, you know, or they can't control what they're going to do with their technique. They make mistakes. They've ingrained bad things. That's all from a practical standpoint. So it's just not a good, it's not really a good measure of difficulty or assessing, you know, fatigue. I guess what you would do with an RPE scale or with the RPE scale is, I guess, add those numbers up to get an idea of what your total fatigue load for the week would be. Whereas in weightlifting, you know, you're not gonna be in that place. You can probably do quite a bit more work before it starts to actually negatively impact you than what, you know, let's say in powerlifting, you're gonna do, you know, 4 workouts or 3 squat workouts, and your total RPE for that week is gonna be, you know, 30 or whatever. We add up this much volume at this much RPE, and that's our training load.
I think too, the nature of the snatch and the clean and jerk versus, you know, particularly the squat and the deadlift, they're so much different from like an energetic standpoint that as fatigue is introduced to the snatch or the clean and jerk, it's going to cause too much of a decay in technical qualities or speed qualities to be able to make the lifts. Or a little bit of fatigue is going to create a much bigger issue compared to a similar amount of fatigue in the squat or the deadlift. I also think because the lifts, doing like one snatch or one clean and jerk, from a heart rate standpoint, I think it gets your heart, like, maybe it's just being like less familiar with the lifts and I'm like stressed while I'm doing them. But I feel doing like light weights in the snatch for a triple, percentage wise of what it is compared to the squat, I'm much more tired from doing 3 snatches than from doing 3 squats.
Yeah, for sure. I think I think the if you know, one way to think about it that might make it more because the barbell sort of maybe changes this in people's minds, but if you imagine applying RPE to box jumps, you might be able to do a box jump at, let's say your best box jump ever is 50 inches, and you're doing box jumps all day with 45 inches. Mm-hmm. You're near limit, but it's not that much hard. It's not really that hard to do.
Yeah, it's 90%.
Right. You're just banging them out, no problem. You could probably do a tremendous volume of them. So to say that it's not really like, you know, but then you add a couple inches to that and it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Very much like the Olympic lifts. I think RPE just doesn't really fit well there.
And the also wouldn't be able to use like a rep max calculator. Like, all right, no. I snatched this for a triple.
Yeah.
I did 120 for a triple, so that means I can do 140 for a single. Like those are a big distance apart. So if RPE is not a good way to gauge things for weightlifters, what is?
Well, what you're looking at is the indicators of like the total overload that you're trying to achieve. So increases in 90% lifts across, you know, your period of time that you're overloading. As you start to become successful with more 90% plus lifts, you're going to start to have the effect of that is going to be an increase in your 100% lifts. Total training volume and the total load improving time and time and time, and general strength improving over those time periods are what produce results in the lifts. You're not going to sit there and do, you know, X number of sets and reps, and then, okay, it feels better, I add 5 kilos and do it. You're working at a whole bunch of different things. You're working increasing general fitness, general strength. As those come up, then you're working on more specific things, and then, you know, after the more specific things have come up, you're working at speed and power and making the actual lift, you know, executing the actual lift with maximum intensity. So it's more that the process itself is improving and moving forward rather than, you know, okay, I just do, you know, a PR set of 5 on the snatch, then everything else is going to come up. My 3-rep max snatch is going to come up. It's not necessarily the case. It's much more a matter of improving things technically, improving the physical qualities, and then, you know, realizing those abilities.
Would you say that there's more kind of art and intuition to seeing it?
I think there definitely is. I think there's definitely like a, you know, more experienced coaches have an understanding. They all whether they know exactly that they're gravitating to these things, but they do gravitate to that. There's a sense of how heavy you have to train, how many times you're going to take these heavy weights in a week, how many times you're going to push these numbers, and they kind of gravitate towards those things. I don't know if it's so much. There's probably a little more science to it, where people have really, you know, certain countries and people have really honed in on what's that target we're looking for. You know, Prilipin's table is very much something that was, you know, sort of deduced into, hey, here's what's the sweet spot we want to be, but there's still a big range in there.
Yeah, because it's interesting to watch, you know, that there's not really such thing as there's no grinders in weightlifting, but with the exception of maybe standing up a clean, if that's someone's limiting factor. But it's kind of like it looks easy or it's a miss.
Right.
It's easy or it's a miss. And, yeah, there's some saves here and there, but particularly when you get someone like Courtney, let's say, who's very much it's just this very snappy lift or it's a miss.
Yeah.
I think that makes it even harder to be able to predict, okay, well, you know, 90 or let's say in the snatch, 82 looked this way, and to predict, all right, well, if 82 looked this way, we should go to 84 or 85 or whatever it is.
I think as a coach, what you're always looking at is you have a sense of how fatigued a lifter is from the training. You know the training they're doing because you gave it to them or you know what the training is, and you can gauge from there their level of fatigue based on what they're doing and how they're looking. And when you can see these periods of time where, okay, we've reduced some fatigue and are those qualities that we know are there starting to show.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was a great time before Courtney snatched 90 where she snatched a weight that I thought was 75, but it was 80. And that was really like, I knew she was in great shape because in my mind, like, that should have, I knew exactly what 75 looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And that looked exactly like 75 moves. not like what 80 moves, and she was obviously really strong. So it's an example of like, okay, there's a sense of how somebody's performing, how they should perform based on how tired they're going to be. And then, you know, when we remove those things, we know that they're going to get better as long as the training itself was done correctly.
Yeah. All right. Sweet Ken Music on Instagram asks us if we could be any Mighty Ducks characters from any of the trilogy, which would you be?
Well, I mean, clearly Gordon Bombay.
Yeah. So let's set Bombay aside,
right.
I guess, because...
Oh. That's a tough one. If we go down the list of people, the people I'm going to just knock off the list first I don't want to be would be Hans, for one. Definitely not.
Because he dies, or...?
Yeah, because he dies. I mean...
He's essentially reincarnated as...
Yeah, but how many other people no one else in the series is dead.
I'm assuming that the actor who played Hans died, and that's why they replaced him with the exact same character.
I heard he just demanded a way too high a salary. $10 million for the role. No one in the movie has died in the series other than him. And so we know, we don't know. There's no evidence to say they're not all going to live forever. So Hans is off. Goldberg, just because... I mean, you know, you don't really want to go through your life as Goldberg, the butt of the joke. That's a tough one. I'm going to say Charlie's probably like the generic catch-all kind of character. Mm-hmm. But the possibility Gordon Bombay's, you know, your mom, yeah, that could be cool.
That could be cool. that wasn't what I was expecting you to say. I think I would be... When I was a kid, I would have said Dean Portman for sure. Because I was like, yeah, this guy lifts. Yeah. This guy is the only one who lifts.
That's true.
So for sure, I said Dean Portman. But now looking at it, I'm thinking Russ, the knuckle puck guy.
Oh.
He's got good branding. He has a very unique shot.
Yeah.
He raises himself up out of the hood. Granted, he was in the friendliest hood possible.
It was a Disney hood.
It was definitely the Disney hood. Because, one, we all know the black people in South Central LA were never playing fucking roller hockey.
No, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're taking some artistic liberties already in this movie through the ideas of, you know, youth hockey coaches receiving Malibu mansions or
slight liberties
or people giving a shit about youth hockey. But maybe the biggest artistic liberty they take is when the puck gets hit over the fence while they're out, you know, playing Russ and his mm-hmm. brother and all their friends and learning how to be tough, and the stick stick gloves shirt kind of move. The puck flies over the fence, smashes this dude's window.
Mm-hmm.
And they just say, hey, can you throw it back? And he just, oh, yeah, here you go, guys. Here's
I don't give a fuck.
Alley-oop. He says alley-oop. Well, of course, Boom Shakalaka is playing just a amazing song.
Well, because that's a byproduct. That societal quandary there is a byproduct of Gordon Bombay's impact on the human race. They have forgiven. They can forgive anything as long as people are. That's the next generation of Pee Wee hockey. And he can't possibly be angry because they're the future.
They are the future. Because it's like, you know, when Tiger Woods came up and started being great at golf, it created this cultural expanse. You know, golf just used to be for old white guys, and now Tiger Woods is good, and it's like, oh, we're getting this huge influx of youth and you know, new people interest in golf. I wonder if the NHL was like, hey, Disney, let's slip this character in here. You know, the games are looking pretty creamy out there. We got to get a little bit of chocolate in the mix. Because there's one black guy in the NHL that I'm aware of, P.K. Subban, and he's really good.
Do you think that – what was the name of the kid in – the Mighty Ducks, the brother,
Russ.
Russ.
Yeah.
Do you think Russ, the sex addict, as Tiger Woods was?
We're getting really off topic here, but before Tiger Woods' demise, And I have people who can corroborate this. I had told them, I said, I bet, it was half betting and half wishful thinking, that for as buttoned up and polished as Tiger Woods was in his personal or in his professional settings and press conferences and stuff, I was hoping like as soon as he took the mic off, as soon as he was behind closed doors, that he was just gangster as shit.
Oh yeah,
I hoped for that, and he kind of was. If you hear the recordings of his phone calls, like telling his mistress, he sounds like Dave Chappelle's impression of a white guy. could you please delete my phone number from your cell phone?
Oh my god!
So he didn't quite have the gangster lean to it. I mean, he had the misbehaving
like a Wayne Brady
part of it.
Kind of. But he was.
But you could
bad man.
Ask Paul. Paul will tell you that I had predicted Tiger Woods not being what everyone thought years in advance.
He was into that.
Yeah. If you guys want to ask about any other movies besides Mighty Ducks, I mean, we can talk about that a lot, but go ahead and send. We love talking that kind of bullshit, so send those kind of questions in anytime you want. All right. JBaron531 asks, what role does single leg training play in weightlifting?
It plays a supportive role in, for one, if you have any kind of muscular imbalance or issues with your hips, that's the first place it would come up. And then, you know, as a secondary thing in like the general phases, incorporating some kind of like lunge type exercises. I know it seems common sense that, if you do lunges, they're like doing jerks, but the positions are very different, even though the muscles trained are very similar. You're not really mimicking an identical technique with a lunge as you would in like a split jerk, but it still has some benefit. And, you know, it's really good, I think, one thing to incorporate like the opposite leg that you jerk with in some kind of lunge fashion so you can kind of keep balance in your hips. It seems like there's a definite possibility for lifters to develop some kind of imbalance in their hips if they never ever change the hip. It's also just it's a good general training kind of protocol.
How many split squats did the Bulgarians do?
To my knowledge, no Bulgarian has ever done split squats. I know Angel Spasov came here in like the late 80s and told everybody this, and him and Terry Todd were telling everyone like, yeah, like the Bulgarians do step-ups.
Step-ups is what I've heard,
do step-ups. When I asked Abhijayev and Martin Pashov about this, they had never even heard of any of this.
Yeah, they're like, what the fuck is a step-up? You mean walking up the stairs?
I can't remember exactly, but Abhijayev was like, who's Angel Spasov? Like, there was definitely, it could also be just that he's, an old man not understanding the questions, but, it was definitely not like, that was not a thing. They didn't talk about the magic of step-ups or split squats. And Martin had never – why do you call it Bulgarian? Like, we don't do those. We've never done those. But
it does add a little bit of mystique to an exercise, though, to put a Eastern Bloc kind of country attached to it.
For sure. Romanian deadlifts, Bulgarian split squats. The other one, Russian twists. I'm trying to think of other cool ones.
Brazilian benches.
What's that one?
Canadian curls.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Canadian curls, that sounds.
Mexican muscle-ups.
The Molson muscle-up. The impossible sit-up.
Well, the atomic sit-up.
The atomic sit-up.
That's how they got Perkis.
Perkis.
That's how they got Perkis. That's where it all began.
Oh, that's true.
The takedown.
That's true.
Of Tony Perkis all began with an atomic sit-up situation.
Tony Perkis, another fitness icon, fitness demigod, pioneer in his strategy. I would go so far as to say Tony Perkis may be the originator or the original RP diet template.
He definitely invented CrossFit.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah,
what Tony Perkis was doing in heavyweights is not unlike what people do to themselves now. Electrocution, shame, all of these things.
Pull-ups in precarious locations.
Oh.
smashing blocks of ice on their stomach.
Psychologically destroying fat children.
Well, yeah, that's always fun. Overcoming devil logs. All right. Cleaver by Half on Instagram asks us, hey, guys, what is your opinion regarding the efficacy of daily undulating periodization programming for powerlifting? You know, it's a big question because it's not a program, you know, so that there's – it's just – it's an idea. It's a strategy, and it can be done very well, and there are people who do it very well. I think that it has, you know, an inherent weakness in it that it's trying to develop multiple qualities at once rather than having dedicated time to specific qualities. And when looking at long-term training strategy, you know, training for 5 years, 10 years, if you have dedicated time periods to hypertrophy, to strength, to peaking, you're going to raise those to a higher level than you would trying to simultaneously train them. But that can be relatively mitigated by doing DUP well. My criticism would be is that so many people fail to do it well, and they fail in a couple more common regards I see. They have too wide of an undulation of sets and reps, or of reps specifically within the same week or within the same mesocycle. You know, they're doing threes and twelves, threes on a Tuesday, twelves on a Friday. Those are trying to develop different qualities, which are going to compete with each other and diminish the effect of each one. So that becomes problematic. You have people who maybe don't have enough variation or phasic structure to it in the long term, so that they're always going heavy. They're always going for rep maxes. They're always going for AMRAPs, and it builds up too much fatigue, or they get too good at doing volume, at doing really high volume. And you know, you might hear that and think like, whoa, you know, doing volume is really important. And yes, doing volume is really important, but doing volume at the appropriate time is more important. Being good at sets of 8, 10, and 12, you know, AMRAP of 12 reps in the deadlift, that's great 16 weeks out. When it's not great is when you're doing an AMRAP and doing 6 reps in the deadlift a week out, 10 days out, because you're not developing the neural quality of the one rep max, which as you approach closer and closer to competition becomes more and more important. You're not developing the same degree of technical prowess for the one rep max as you get closer and closer to competition. So that becomes problematic for it. And then I think people, and this can, some of these can be true of any, you know, style of programming or strategy of programming, is that people are inappropriately loading things for themselves. And I see, you know, there's been this huge influx into powerlifting. That's awesome that people come in and they are passionate about doing, they're enthusiastic about getting strong and training hard, and they latch on to a DUP program, let's say, or a coach or whatever it may be, and they want to train really hard, and their own enthusiasm does them in. And I see it happen maybe more frequently with daily undulating periodization style of training than I do with some other styles, because it's almost always RPE. It includes a lot of AMRAPs very often. And when you're inexperienced, you know, less than 2-3 years of serious training, you can't effectively assess RPE. It's just highly, highly unlikely that someone with a year or 2 years of lifting experience is going to be able to properly assign themselves a number. And their own enthusiasm is going to do them in the sense that when they're supposed to do an 8, they do a 9, but they want it, but they call it an 8, or they do a 10 and call it a 9. And I see this even more with female lifters, because their female lifters are better at doing reps at relatively higher intensities. That the RPE or the AMRAPs really catch up to them, because then they start compounding volume with bad technique or with broken down technique as they go. Because, and I'm sure Max, you've seen this too, the one that really stands out in my mind is We had a girl at the Arnold 2 years ago at the booth. We had a 1.5 times body weight squat for max reps, like a contest.
Yeah.
And when she was at 4 reps, I was like, all right, 5 or 6. She's going to make 5 or 6. She did 15.
All super, super slow, right?
Yeah, all super slow, all just this, you know, progressively rougher and rougher technique. But because the weight's not that heavy, just because they're not experienced enough to really be, you know, or close enough to their career peak to really be lifting a heavy weight, they're still able to do the reps, but they're not ingraining what they want. You know, they're not developing the skill of lifting the way that they want. And when you load over and over, more volume, more intensity, more close to failure or to failure training on not the best technique, then you're really going to open yourself up to injury. The more intensely you load that improper movement pattern, the more deeply it's going to be ingrained. So it's going to be harder to fix that technique as you go forward. So again, the structure can be done very well, and there are people who do it very well. But I see so many people messing it up and doing training that, in my estimation, is needless.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing such high frequency and such high volume that they're training too close to their MRV very often. You know, a contrast to this would be like Marissa versus any of her competitors. She's training 45 minutes to maybe an hour and a half on the longest sessions. I mean, she's made an entire totals, not trying to rush necessarily. I mean, she kind of has to go fast because of work schedule sometimes, but she totaled over 900 in 57 minutes once.
Yeah.
Like she went 319, 198, 374 or something in 57 minutes. Where I hear about other people, you know, training 3, 4, 5 hour sessions.
There's something that I think, and I'm curious actually your opinion of this, but if we look at mean effective volume, right?
Mean jerk time.
Maximum adaptive volume. Mm-hmm. The gap between maximum adaptive volume and maximum recoverable volume is much, much larger than we think it is, than might seem apparent. Where, and I, from my own experience, have trained 40 hours a week and seen the physical ability to do the work. I could do all the work, but there's no adaptations happen. There's nothing coming of that volume, of that training. So I and it'd be interesting to see your thoughts, is that it seems like what happens with the daily undulating folks is that there's this concept, this belief that, well, they're super, super fatigued, but when they decay all of that fatigue and the deload or the taper, they'll have this, you know, humongous curve, this giant supercompensation, which may be that there's just so much emphasis or belief that that effect is bigger than it really is, or it's been, you know, kind of eliminated because there's just too much fatigue and adaptations.
That's kind of the other problem I see. And this, again, it's not inherent to DUP programming. It's just a lot of people I see who train in this manner make this mistake as well. They never decay that fatigue, or they not on time.
Right.
You know, that they're 5 days out doing multiple triples at 80%.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not talking about 52 kilo women doing that, even though that wouldn't be appropriate for them either, because what the hell is triples worth when you're that close to a meet?
Yeah, pointless.
But that's like 93, 105 kilo men. There's no way a strong guy is going to do 5 triples in the squat at 80% 5 days out and decay that fatigue to be prepared for a meet.
Right, right. Yeah, so, I mean,
and more often than not, I mean, there's people who I'm sure train phasic structure that we promote or Westside or DUP or whatever who make the exact same mistake. But I see it more frequently with those.
Yeah. It seems to me that the DUP is not as well suited to training a sport that has one motor quality, that is literally just force production, because you can develop with unidirectional training, you know, a block style, more of what we're talking about, modern periodization, where you can develop so much more to those qualities before you need to move to the next. And the more advanced you get, the more training volume needs to be devoted to those qualities to improve them.
And the more appropriately timed their development right. is.
Yeah. So it seems, it just seems to me like it's not, it seems like it's not that it's a bad idea or that's wrong. I think the thing is more that its application is so difficult to get right or very easy to get wrong that it's just, it's kind of like, you know, it's like the Frankfurt Airport. It's like, great idea. I'm sure that architect was just killing it, but...
Dieter. This is from the other podcast. You would have had to listen to the previous...
Oh, yeah. Our listeners listen to all of them, so...
I'd hope they do. Dieter. That's him.
Yeah, just kind of a...
Dieter and his fucking monkey designing that goddamn airport. Dieter.
More moving parts equals more potential for error, yeah. right? So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's there's a lot of possible avenues to go astray where, you know... Also, and my experience, and totally my own experience, is just from what I've seen, like with the Bulgarians, so much energy devoted to so few of the scientific principles: overload, specificity, and if you want to maximize those, you include some kind of fatigue management, and you have right off the bat a program that's going to be very successful. To have all these other needed, you know, like unnecessary parts moving around in there, can be problematic, I think.
So next question comes from A_Helmar, and he or she asks, what's the difference between Russian pull and the Chinese pull? Which is best and why? And this question, Max's answer to this question is not necessarily specifically about these techniques, but it's the concept of trying to say this technique is better than that technique. And so lay it on me.
Technique, there's really, when we're talking about technique, there's two things. There's the mechanics of lifting, what your body has to do or what your body does or anyone's body does when they're doing a snatch or a clean, in this case, a pull, versus are what we see them doing, which would be the style of technique. So while Chad and I both may do a clean pull, our bodies are hitting the same critical events throughout that pull. At some point in the pull, we're breaking the bar off the ground. We become a combined unit. Our knees hit maximum extension.
Each of us and the bar become a combined unit. Yeah. Not Max and I combining as some sort of...
Captain Planet type scenario.
Transformer situation.
Knees hit, you know, maximum extension, maximum flexion, maximum extension. The bar moves. All of those mechanics all happen for every single lift done. Whether it's the ugliest fucking lift you ever saw or the prettiest lift you ever saw, the mechanics are the same. The style, how Chad executes those movements, those events, and how I execute them might look very, very different, but what's happening is the same, right? So the way a Chinese snatch pull or clean pull looks versus a Russian snatch pull or clean pull looks is more a byproduct of the anatomy of the lifter executing the movement. You would say the same thing in a little easier analogy, I think, because the movements are less complex, are like squats. Somebody with really short legs and a long body does a squat. They look super upright, and it's really like aesthetic, case in point. somebody with really long legs and a short body tips over really far, like a Lane Norton type where it leans way over. We're both doing the same things. We're both bending our knees, lowering our hips, and getting to a certain point of depth, then standing up.
Yeah, the aesthetic of the technique, though, you know, a pretty snatch, a pretty clean, a pretty squat, and the effectiveness of the technique are not the same.
Right.
The aesthetic of the technique is just a made-up idea.
Right. Really. That's just what we're seeing, it how it manifests itself. So while you look at, you know, the Russian pulls or the Chinese pulls. And what you're really probably asking the question is when Chinese lifters do the pull where they pull themselves down afterward.
A panda pull?
The panda pull. Been done way before Instagram existed. There, you know, Jim Schmitz showed me pictures of guys doing it in like the 60s. Clever idea. I'm going to do a pull and I'm going to pull myself down like I'm going to the bar. I mean, it's insignificant.
Well, I think what they're asking is the more upright.
Oh, the actual pull, the lift.
Open knee, more open
the
position.
The actual pull.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great example of the anatomy of the lifter dictating what the events look like. So when the Russians pull, let's say the Russian guy's back's a little bit shorter, he's more of longer legs, longer limbs. He pulls, the angles that his knee extend to, the angle that his knee flexes to, the position of his hips, those things are dictated by his anatomy. And they're done not because he chose to do them that way, they're done because his body is best suited to do them that way.
Yeah, and that is the point to hammer home, is generally Eastern Europeans, let's say Western Europeans or even right. Eastern Europeans, have different body type, different limb proportions than Asians. So while Klokov stays way over the bar with, you know, this higher hip position, and Liu Xiaojun, you know, has a very upright torso throughout the lift, they both snatch a shitload of weight.
Yeah.
That is the best thing. The best technique is that which produces the best result.
Right.
And if Liu Xiaojun tried to snatch like Klokov and Klokov tried to snatch like Liu, they wouldn't produce the best result for themselves. No. So that is where you have to cut off this thinking of this style is the best style, you know, a blanket best style, or that one is the best style, because they're just different.
Right. Well, and if you look at the logical conclusion of different lifters' anatomy dictate the way they do the movements or the way the movements look, that is the next step, is that's how their training program should reflect the things they need to develop. You know, I think in the more, you know, Eastern European countries, maybe they're going to spend more time on the areas they're weakest. Maybe they squat with much bigger weights and they spend more energy on that. Maybe when you have lifters who don't have issues with the strength of their legs because their legs are very short and it's easy to develop strength there, they do more exercises for their back. So it's the technique is determined by the anatomy, right? Everything starts with the anatomy of the lifter, because that dictates the style which they execute the lift, which dictates what exercises they need to do to support that method of doing the lift, right? So I think it's when you think about different things, don't assign techniques to geographical regions. If there was a Chinese guy that looked just like, some, you know, tall, lanky, short torso, kind of like, you know, the typical, deadlifter type body, he'd lift a lot like the Europeans. He'd lift like, or the South Americans who have, you know, more of that body type. It's just much more, it's determined by the anatomy of the lifter. It's not going to be determined by, you know, the actual country of origin or some training method they develop.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it's generalities talking about
the body
types. It's not that one is better than the other as a blanket statement for everyone. It's this style is better for this limb proportion, this style is better for this proportion.
Yeah.
And effectively assessing, you know, what you are, what your athletes tend towards more, and then fitting the program around that.
Yeah, very much.
A name I can't pronounce, Katovikamir, is asking about, you know, if someone, a trainee, cannot do the full technique safely, or they do not have the requisite movement ability to do the, you know, a squat effectively or a deadlift effectively, what adjustments can you make? You know, so, and this is in regards to our audience, probably if you're dealing with like a rank beginner, you're a personal trainer, you're a coach that works with high school athletes, whatever, you have someone that comes in and they cannot squat to depth. They cannot do a deadlift from the floor without, you know, looking like a question mark. What adjustments can you make to get them there? Some of these are more, you know, Dr. Quinn type of questions, and check out Clinical Athlete for that. A new Clinical Athlete has its own podcast as well.
What? Now,
yeah, it's new. One
episode. He's a podcast?
He does.
And we haven't been on it yet?
They've only had one episode, so okay. It does seem like it's been a little bit long.
All right. Is it video? Is there a video release?
Yeah, I did. I think I did see a video.
Wow. Thanks, Quinn. Thanks.
They'll be better served. You know, you'd be better served to listen to them as far as movement assessment and figuring out, you know, not trying to make
we're not doctors, despite our vast knowledge of the human body.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not trying to make kind of these generalizations in regards to where someone is lacking mobility. But Quinn has a great video, like, and we'll link it here in the info about assessing and improving overhead squat movement. How, you know, you have to eliminate. Is it the ankle? Is it the hip? Is it the shoulder? Is it the lumbar spine? You know, which is restricting it? Because too many people are just throwing, you know, all the exercises at it, and right. Two or three of them are probably useless because the person has the requisite movement. So you need to effectively assess it, and they're the resource to go to with that. But then you want to get to whatever movement regression is appropriate. So for the squat, if someone cannot back squat, then, you know, can they front squat? That's oftentimes a lot more natural movement for people. Can they front squat with their heels elevated? If that can't happen, all right, then can they goblet squat? Holding a kettlebell or a dumbbell or a plate out in front of the body for the counterbalance. If the answer is still no, then we're maybe moving to a front foot elevated split squat. But you need to get the work done in the exercise that can be done effectively and can be done safely, while simultaneously to that, working on the appropriate movement qualities, doing the breathing, doing the 90-90 and the half kneeling work that's going to fix the existing deficiency. And this is particularly important with, I think, team sport type of athletes or non-strength athletes. If you want to be a powerlifter, if you want to be a weightlifter, you got to do the lifts. You know, that is the sport. You have to do squats. You have to do benches. You have to do deadlifts. But if you're a football player, a basketball player, a soccer player, whatever, yeah, cleans are great. High bar, Astagrass squats are great. But they're not necessary. The only thing that is necessary is the sport practice. All the weight room type of stuff, which strength coaches get so caught up in, you know, weight room numbers are only a means to an end. They're a means to improve performance, to improved movement. And if someone has a shit-looking squat, then having them do a bunch of shit-looking squats isn't probably going to improve their movement. If anything, it's going to exacerbate existing problems. It's going to lead to injury. Now, working on why their squat looks like shit is good, while alongside that, doing the movement regression that's appropriate for them. So if you work with athletes, and again, non-athletes that don't have a barbell in their sport, keep in mind that a squat is like a movement category for them. It does not mean barbell back squat. It means, you know, knee, ankle, hip flexion exercise, bend the knee and stand up, whether that's high bar back squat, box squat, front squat, goblet squat, belt squat, leg press, front foot elevated split squat. All of those could be appropriate for different athletes, and observing what they're doing and making sure that they can do the exercise effectively and safely so they're not going to injure themselves, that they can create some output with it, they can actually use some weight to provide some strength stimulus, and then that it's an appropriate fit within the total context of their training plan. That's what you want to look at for them. But again, if you're looking to learn more about movement and how to assess and improve that stuff, we got the Mobility Myths playlist on our channel here, clinicalathlete.com, Clinical Athlete YouTube, all the great stuff from Dr. Quinn Hennock and his book, Weightlifting Movement Assessment and Optimization.
Couldn't say it any better.
And our last question for the day from Koya Callen. I might be saying that right. When traveling to a meet across the country/world, especially in a place with a different time zone, yes, if it is across the country or world, it will definitely be in a different time zone, what are some things to consider? So, you know, Marissa and I just got back from IPF Worlds, winning IPF Worlds. Well, she did most of the winning. I did most of the standing around. But yeah, that was, I think for us, we left. We had a 7:15 flight out of LAX that on a Sunday night, we got to Germany at about 4 p.m. on Monday, local time, and then finally got to Belarus at about midnight, Monday night, Tuesday morning, local time, and that was an hour time difference. We ended up with a 9-hour time change. Lots of lifters.
It's only 9 hours difference?
Yeah.
You're just going all the way around. Could have just gone the other way.
Lots of lifters were definitely affected by that. Marissa certainly had some effects from the travel, the time change. Yeah, just the human body is probably not meant to fly in a pressurized cylinder for, the better part of a day. I've traveled to Australia 4 times to compete, and I've made my 2 biggest totals of my life, 23:14 and 23:25, both in Australia, which is a 15-hour direct flight from Los Angeles. So I feel maybe uniquely qualified to give some advice here. I think the first thing that you have to do to effectively compete with traveling is not give it a lot of mental power. If you go into it thinking, I'm not going to lift well because, or I'm not going to lift as well as I could because of this travel, you're already set yourself back. Now, that's not to say to be unrealistic in denying that it is a consideration to make. I think there were people at Worlds definitely who thought, well, who tried to do that, who tried to think, well, it doesn't matter if I'm in my back, if I'm at my home gym or if I'm nine time zones away in Belarus, I'm going to lift just as well as I could. That's unrealistic. But you can't go into it thinking like, well, I'm totally screwed because we're going so far away. So once you establish like you're going to make as effective of a plan, you're going to control what you can control and don't worry about what you can't in this cross-country or around the world competition, then you have to look at the things that you can control, which starts with the flight or starts maybe before you take off, in that you're packing everything you need. You're bringing your own food onto the plane. You're buying water at the airport to take onto the plane. You're wearing, compression pants, compression socks, compression shirt, all the compression things you can wear on an airplane. That's all going to be very, very helpful to you. If you're on a 12-hour flight, a 15-hour flight, airplane food generally sucks. So bringing your own food with you, stuff that travels well, like trail mix, like beef jerky, protein shakes, those are all really, really easy to bring on the plane, and you can, pass on the airplane food and do as good a job of hitting your macros as you can by bringing your own food. Definitely bring water, plenty of water, as well as, taking airborne emergency vitamin C type of stuff in the days leading up to the travel on the plane. You're getting recirculated air from 200 people on an airplane, coughing, sneezing,
including people's farts. You're breathing that shit in.
Lots of farts being breathed in. So planning effectively for all that stuff. Now, how big the time change is would affect any attempt to ready yourself, like to kind of try and pre-adjust to the time change to go to sleep a little bit, hour later or hour earlier, for a couple days before. But I've never found a big... Yeah. When I go to Australia, I think that's a 18-hour time difference. So it's really like a six. It's a day change with a 6-hour time difference. Day ahead, 6 hours behind. If that made sense. Like noon, if it's noon on Tuesday here, it's 6 a.m. on Wednesday there. So that's not a terrible time change. The Belarus one was pretty bad. 9 hours difference.
Yeah,
is a pretty bad one. But you kind of have to just force yourself to go to sleep as close to the regular time as possible. but really look at the cumulative amount of sleep you're getting in the couple days prior to competition. If the day before you compete, you don't sleep, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. like you would at home, that's not that huge of a deal, assuming that in the 2-3 days prior to that, whether it's through sleeping at night or naps or whatever, you've accumulated kind of the same amount of sleep that you would regularly have gotten in those days.
I remember they actually did like a research on sleep deprivation with weightlifters, the OTC, years ago. Mm-hmm. And they basically had one group that was sleep deprived for one day, and they were able to execute the same amount of work with the same level of performance as the group that did sleep, or when they did sleep, but they just complained more. They said it felt a lot worse, but their actual physical performance didn't suffer at all. 2 days of sleep deprivation, there was a decline, right? So, like you say, that's the biggest thing, is that you're making up for everything that could potentially go wrong getting closer to the day of the competition.
Yeah, so the big stuff, plan ahead, take your own food, take your own water. If particularly the more obscure the place you're going is, the more unknown its food quality may be. World's Strongest Man, probably 4 years ago when it was in China, Brian Shaw brought all his own food. Everyone else was eating what they had there. Everyone else got sick, lost 20 pounds in a week, and he won. Big fucking surprise. Yeah. The guy who didn't get food poisoning and lose 20 pounds won.
Yeah.
He controlled what he could control. So, make a list, check it off, make sure you're bringing all the stuff you need. Compression, attire, really long flight, using some sort of EMS device, Compex, Power Dot, that type of thing can be useful. It may make the people on the plane around you a little bit nervous as you hook a bunch of wires and electrodes to yourself.
I've done a lot of athletes I've worked with have done that kind of thing.
If you're on a 12-hour flight, make sure you get up, move around, go back to where the bathrooms are for a little bit more space and stretch a little bit. Avoid.
We flew to New Zealand. I didn't stand up one time.
Yeah, on two or three different Australia flights, not stood up at all.
Yeah.
Because on those really long flights, I'd prefer to sit in the window because I know I'm not going to have to go pee very much.
Yeah.
And, maybe one time for the whole flight. So I don't want to be in the aisle having to get up five times for someone else.
Yeah. That's the worst.
Yeah. But, from a performance standpoint, you want to get up, you want to move around. Even if it's just while you're sitting in your chair, kind of like a little toe lift type of things, just keeping your legs moving, keeping the blood flowing a little bit better there.
Yeah. Yeah. All really good points. Preparation, prepare a little bit ahead. The food one's a huge one. That's really big. People seem to make a big mistake thinking they're just going to figure it out when they get there, but you have no idea what it's going to be like,
Yeah. We got lucky in Belarus. The Marriott had great food. Yeah. Everywhere else apparently had terrible food. So we lucked out with that, but like I've said in countless other videos and podcasts, control what you can control. Don't worry about what you can't.
Yeah.
At Worlds, we had really four top women in Marissa's weight class. One was coming from the U.S., one was coming from Australia, one was coming from England, and one was coming from Russia. We couldn't control that Olga, probably traveled an hour to get there. Well, Liz was in the same kind of boat that we were. Very, very long travel. Joy, not quite as long, but it didn't matter. That we couldn't make them have a longer flight or a shorter flight or whatever. And just because they had a long one, that doesn't take anything away from us or give anything extra to us. We could only worry about our own stuff. Bring food on the plane, bring the water, wear the compression pants. Marissa can tell you about when she's having to put my compression socks on for me as we're waiting to get on the plane to Australia.
Oh,
I can't, those socks are too tight. I can't put them on myself.
Well, they're compression socks.
Yeah, that's most of the reason why I wear Sperry's all the time, is regular shoes are a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Just slip them on. Uh-huh. And socks plus regular shoes, that's twice.
Socks.
Twice the work.
Socks and shoes, it's a lifestyle.
Not one that I'm living. I'm not living the shoes and socks lifestyle. So that's the questions for today. Yeah. So what do we have coming up? You don't have that seminar.
I don't have a seminar then. I guess if you work at Facebook headquarters, the first weekend, August 2nd, I believe it's a Monday or a Tuesday. I'll be at your job doing a little squat seminar for some of the folks that do a little exercising at the Facebook headquarters.
What do you think, Skynet, that Zuckerberg is in your squat workshop at Facebook?
I requested. I said Zuckerberg can be there, but he better keep his mouth shut when I'm talking.
That would be amazing.
You may know some things about the interwebs, but son, your squat's fucked up.
If I had to bet, there's going to be a lot of really shitty looking squats.
Oh, it's going to be rough.
That'll be fun though. It's going to be cool to.
I'm bringing Shorty is probably coming up, whether he knows it or not. He's going to catch quite a bit of video. Juggernaut at Facebook.
That will be
Juggerface.
Then we'll be August 26th and 27th. Max and I will be in Buffalo, New York at Mustache Fitness, bringing you our first Super Total clinic. So that's one weekend, powerlifting and weightlifting, teaching you how the techniques of the lifts, teaching you how to program for each sport independently, and how to effectively combine the two. After that, Marissa and I will be in Philadelphia on September 15th, giving a presentation on program design at Warhorse Barbell. Our Sunday technique clinic there is already sold out. And then October 28th, we'll be at the Movement Minneapolis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, hometown of Gordon Bombay.
There's a parade for him every year.
Do you think any of the Mighty Ducks will be there?
If they give a damn. If they haven't fallen off the wagon of fame. How big do you think their houses are? I bet they're fucking mansions. I bet they live in castles.
I bet they all live in the Mall of America.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. They probably have, apartments, penthouses in the Mall of America. You have to ride the roller coaster to get to their house. It's actually, visualize this here. It's a cross between Blank Check and Mighty Ducks. We'll call it Mighty Ducks 5. Skip 4. Go to 5. There it is.
Yeah, I did notice Marissa had never seen either Mighty Ducks movie. And maybe it's just because we've been talking about it so much lately, is that I basically forced upon her watching Mighty Ducks 1 and 2 in the last few weeks. And in Mighty Ducks 1, young Gordon Bombay is played by the same actor who is the first kid in the movie First Kid.
Wait, what?
Uh-huh.
Gordon Bombay's father was the president of the United States?
I think that's the implication.
Do you think Sinbad? Sinbad was in that, correct?
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the actor Sinbad, the thespian Sinbad, was in First Kid as the number one numero uno bodyguard.
Yeah, Secret Service agent.
Secret Service agent. I don't know.
But that era of Disney movies, 93 to 97, it was really just a recycling the same people into all the different movies.
These guys were awesome
in Mighty Ducks. And they're all fat. Here's another movie for you.
Yeah, heavyweights. Do you think that?
We'll get all the fat ones together. Yeah. We'll make another movie with them.
If they lose weight, we'll make another one. Do you think that they must be in contract or something? They just picked from the same pool. This is something interesting. Back to Sinbad. I didn't know this was a thing because I remember watching a movie called Shazam. But apparently, and I just remembered it from nothing. I didn't go on Reddit chat forums and talk about it all the time, despite what some user's name might say. But apparently it's not a thing. It never existed.
Doesn't exist.
The movie Shazam did not exist with Sinbad. There's a movie Kazam,
which unfortunately exists with Shaq.
Shaq, incredible, but Shazam, not a thing. But I remember watching it, and lots of people do. Apparently, there's a phenomenon where lots of people believe they've seen it.
Now, do you think this is a similar phenomenon to the time that Dennis Reynolds was trying to write his memoirs Dennis Reynolds a sexual life, and he's going to make the stigmatas in his hands, and they knock him out, and he wakes up in a dream, we later find out in a dream, in which he is in an insane asylum being tormented by Sinbad and Rob Thomas. Do you recall the episode?
I remember the episode. Yes.
It's Sinbad's house. You're my bitch now.
So, okay. Sinbad is blinked now.
Maybe you underwent the same kind of experience that Dennis Reynolds did.
Whilst writing my memoirs.
Yeah. It was
Max Ada, Montana life.
Yeah, you thought you were watching a Sinbad movie, similarly to how Dennis Reynolds thought he was being tormented by Sinbad in an insane asylum, but it was all just a figment of your imagination.
I don't even know now. I feel like I've gone in this rabbit hole. Either way, perhaps we're missing something. The bigger thing here is that Sinbad is potentially has some kind of
shapeshifter?
Psychic shape-shifting powers.
Quantum leaping?
Quantum Leap, another fantastic series.
All right,
Bakula.
This episode will be too long if we talk about all this. So check out those clinics through the events section at store.jtsstrength.com. Coming up very soon, maybe even by the time this podcast is released, will be a book by Mr. Max Ada.
Yes.
Weightlifting Technique Triad, Exercise Classification and Selection. So this kind of stuff we were talking about with, the Chinese pole versus the Russian pole and assessing technique from a more objective eye and how that will shape program exercise selections for a program and program design is all covered in their big classifications of exercises for you to be able to very simply look and I have this problem. Well, this exercise helps address it. So make sure to be on the lookout for that. That is the Weightlifting Technique Triad, Exercise Classification and Selection, only at jtsstrength.com. Check out our online coaching, juggernautcoaching.com, powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, multiple different levels of it. Whatever you're kind of ready for, we probably have something appropriate for you. Beyond that, subscribe to the YouTube channel. We're always very proud of the content we produce here. If you like the podcast, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny. That stuff really helps with the iTunes charts and helps more people find us so they can learn how to lift things more better.
Very true.
All right. Until the next time. Thank you.